Next case is State of Ohio versus Joseph W. Jones. 6-6-1606 and 6-1851. Mr. Cartwright Jones.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Reese Cartwright Jones. I'm here for the State of Ohio and the Mahoning County Prosecutor's Office. If it pleases the court, I'll speak for 5 minutes. My colleague Henry Appel from the Attorney General's Office will speak for five, also reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal. This court already held in State versus Griggs as of 2004 that substantial compliance attaches to all non-constitutional portions of Criminal Rule 11, regardless of the degree of offense. Now, as of 1990 in State versus Nero, this court recognized that the rights of information, often contained and cited in Criminal Rule 11B, the rights to know the definitions of pleas of guilty, not guilty, and no contest, are non-constitutional and subject to substantial compliance, and further, that the failure to mention those requires some showing of prejudice on the part of an appellant or defendant seeking to have that guilty plea vacated for a trial court's failure to mention the same. Now, the issue here before this court, as submitted on certified conflict, is basically whether this court's decision in Watkins as of 2003 indicates that the only way to comply with the notification portions of Criminal Rule 11E is to notify the defendant of, as expressly set out in Criminal Rule 11B, the definitions of the pleas of guilty, not guilty, and no contest. Now, the Seventh District Court of Appeals, in this case and in two cases that it cited prior, indicated that that was the only means of compliance. But as the state submits, looking to this court's syllabus holding in Watkins, recitation of 11B is one of many ways that a court could comply with the notification portions. And again, that Watkins and the prior two cases cited require only a showing of substantial compliance. As to substantial compliance in State versus Horton-Alamar, and decisions of like-minded courts, basically that requires the court to identify to a defendant the maximum sentence he might receive and to strictly comply with notifying the defendant of the constitutional rights he waives by entering a guilty plea, those of a trial by jury, the right to an appeal thereafter, his right to remain silent in entering his guilty plea, et cetera, et cetera. As we argued on brief, substantial compliance serves the constitutional purposes and principles of the guilty plea statute.
Why should we, when a court doesn't do what is so clearly a requirement set out by the statute, court, for whatever reason, takes a shortcut, doesn't want to use the word of the statute, why do we say substantial compliance is okay? It seems to me that there are many areas in which the law is gray. It's difficult to know exactly what the General Assembly intended. In this situation, the General Assembly has set it out so clearly in B, and yet we continue to get these cases where a trial court simply doesn't follow the statute, clear statute, and so we're asked to sort of fix it for them. To me, as you know from other opinions, I'm frustrated with that we're asked to, well, the trial court didn't quite get it right, but they got kind of close. And so that means every case in which a trial court does that becomes an issue, and an expensive issue, time-consuming issue, when the trial court could have just done it the way the statute says the trial court should do it. What's your response to that?
We recognize that this court, indeed in State v. Nero, stated directly the best practice is just to recite the language of the statute and strictly comply. But a slip of the tongue, a word missing from the transcript.
Well, this is more than a slip of the tongue. isn't it, in this case?
And to a certain extent, no. This case actually is directly analogous to this court's 2004 decision in State versus Nero. In State versus Nero, State versus Griggs, 2004, defendant Griggs received what trial courts typically use, a guilty plea form, indicating that he had the right to plead guilty, not guilty, or no contest. He appealed, saying, wait a minute, at my plea hearing, I was not informed of my right to plead guilty, and indeed what that plea entailed. Well, here we have the same circumstance. Mr. Jones alleges that he was not informed of a no-contest plea or of the effects of a no-contest plea. Now, on the record, there is a plea form indicating that he had the right to plead no contest. Further, as with defendant Griggs, by drawing a direct analogy, he wasn't informed of the effect of the no-contest plea. Following the conclusion of that case, following the Griggs rule, absent a showing of prejudice, and further, absent some showing to abrogate substantial compliance, as that definition was set out, reversal's inappropriate. All there is a
counsel. My understanding of your argument is he didn't plea no contest, so the court didn't have to tell him what the consequences of a no contest plea would be.
We did submit that, yes.
And isn't that ducking the issue of what is required under Criminal Rule 11E, which states that the trial court is to explain the effect of the plea of guilty, which was done, no contest, and not guilty. Black and white, that's what the rule says.
In response, we did submit on brief relative to substantial compliance that, looking to a standard of substantial compliance, the court wasn't required to notify him of a plea he wasn't entering, that substantial compliance, as it's been held, required him to know the things that a defendant would be concerned about when pleading guilty. The maximum.
Well, how was the defendant to know that he could plead to no contest if that wasn't explained to him that that was an option by the court, as just as guilty and not guilty were two options?
He did receive that option on the plea form and could have asked about it. But again, we turn to the second proposition of law, which is prejudice. And on the record as we have it here, first, at the trial court, the term no contest never even appears in that withdrawal transcript, in the Criminal Rule 32 transcript. Further, on brief, there's no issue not to horse the record of what Mr. Jones would have done had he received that option of pleading no contest. Your Honors, I see I'm short on...
Is that necessary that he had to allege what I would have done had I been properly informed and the court complied with Rule 11?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In State versus Griggs, this court cites the Alford case, the United States Supreme Court case in Alford, and expressly says that if the defendant doesn't assert some sort of innocence, or further doesn't assert some sort of prejudice, then the informational portions of Criminal Rule 11B don't merit him relief. Your Honors, I see I'm out of...
I have a question. You'll answer the question. We'll give you time to answer questions. The defendant, as you know, says this is a perfect case to demonstrate why the trial court should have given the instruction pursuant to B, even though he wasn't pleading to no contest. He says, well, if his claim is correct, he and his lawyer didn't exactly see eye to eye, and he claims he didn't realize that no contest was an option. At least that's what I get from the brief. And so it would have been helpful for the judge to have given the defendant that information, wouldn't it?
It could have been helpful, but there's nothing on the record to demonstrate that it would have been. There's no claim of innocence, and there's no claim on the record that was reviewable in that Criminal Rule 32 hearing that would have demonstrated that a no contest option would have required the plea to go any other way. And indeed, he would have lost the 10-day versus 180-day deal with the prosecutor's office by entering that plea. So indeed, had he been offered that option and taken it, the circumstances for...
Is that on the record that... If you plead no contest, I'm going to give you the full 180 days?
That's not on the record, but the deal with the prosecutor's office was you plead guilty and then, you know, we'll give you...
There is no showing. You can't say that to us, that he was going to be prejudiced by entering a no contest plea?
He would have been outside of the scope of his deal with the prosecutor's
office,
yes, Your
Honor. Okay, but that's not the same as saying that the judge would have unquestionably imposed 180 days.
To clarify myself, I'm not suggesting that the judge would have unquestionably imposed 180 days, but he wouldn't have received the benefit of his Rule 11 deal. That is correct, Your Honor.
All right, so you're saying, though, in order to show prejudice, he would have, for example, had to show that he was civilly sued as a result of this flyswatter incident.
That's one example of how a defendant could show prejudice relative to not receiving information on a no-contest plea if he submitted on affidavit and in the criminal Rule 32 hearing that had he been informed that he had a no-contest plea option and that he'd pled guilty, knowing, for instance, that there was a civil suit going on and now that guilty plea could be used against him in the civil suit. That is a good example of prejudice, yes, Your Honor. I do see that I'm out of time, and to not shortchange the Attorney General's office, we're asking for reversal.
Thank you, Mr.
Seventh
Cartwright
District's
Jones. Mr. Appell, do you wish to? It looks like you wish to take argument now. Okay. We have a little less than 5 minutes, Mr. Appell.
If it may please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, I am Henry Appell with the Ohio Attorney General's office, the amicus in this case. The court below did not apply and did not follow this court's holdings in Stewart, Nero, and Griggs. In those cases, this court held two things. First, that the standard of substantial compliance applies to all of the non-constitutional elements, and second, that a defendant who is seeking to withdraw a plea must show prejudice. In this case, the court below did not do either. The Ohio Attorney General is asking this court to do three things. First, to apply Stewart, Nero, and Griggs, and to hold that substantial compliance is all that is required for non-constitutional elements of Criminal Rule 11. The second is to clarify State versus Nero and to the syllabus law, and that prejudice is required to be shown to withdraw a guilty plea, not just for a felony, but also for a misdemeanor. And finally, to hold that in this case that the 10th District's holding would be appropriate, and that a showing of that the defendant's colloquy, wherein the judge explained the maximum possible sentence and the loss of the right of a jury trial, that complies with Criminal Rule 11E.
Let me ask you, your Attorney General's office, you represent hopefully the bigger picture,
yes,
in these cases. And despite the fact we've got Stewart, Nero, and Griggs, if we were to say that the trial courts in these cases simply must comply with the statute, wouldn't that end all of this? Wouldn't that make it so simple for everyone and fair to the defendant, fair to the prosecutor? Everyone knows what the rules are. The General Assembly has set the rules. The judge is supposed to apply them. When the judge doesn't apply the rule as written, we get these, you know, well, maybe the judge got close enough, or maybe it wasn't prejudicial. But it seems to me when the General Assembly has set the policy of the law to say, this is what the trial court needs to do. Very simple, takes probably a minute to do here what the General Assembly says the trial court should do. Isn't that a better approach to this than to have this constant flow of cases where we're trying to figure out whether the trial court got close enough or whether anybody was harmed by the trial court's failure to follow the statute?
Your Honor, we have two responses. The first is that it would require this court to reverse Stewart, Griggs, and Nero.
You don't think we can distinguish them?
Find
them to their facts, or
to set a flat rule that would require the court of appeal that there would be a different rule in misdemeanors than felonies, frankly, would not seem to be a logical position.
No, I agree with that.
Because in fact, what you'd be saying is that a colloquy that would have been adequate for a rapist or a murderer might not be adequate for a litterer.
Right.
That doesn't seem to be a logical result, and requiring strict compliance with Criminal Rule 11E would necessarily lead to that. The substantial compliance requires that, and the prejudice requirements go hand in hand in a procedural and a policy reason, is that it respects the finality of the guilty plea. As the U.S. Supreme Court stated very recently, United States versus Dominguez-Bennett, our system is very, very much premised off of the finality of guilty pleas, and there's a strong desire for that. And I do want to clarify one point on the record. The court below, there was, even though Mr. Jones received a hearing, the words no contest never applied, and he never alleged that his attorney did not explain the possible benefits to a no contest plea over a guilty plea.
And counsel, there was a written plea form that included the term no contest on it. Is that correct?
Yes, there was a form that said the words no contest.
So I mean we're talking about what the trial judge must do, and what the trial judge says in a situation can be combined with what is offered the defendant and his attorney in the form of written materials. Would
yes.
you agree with that?
Yes, and we would submit that the written form is especially relevant in terms of the prejudice analysis. Obviously, Criminal Rule 11 speaks to the trial judge's duties, and it says must inform. Certainly, if you can show that in a form that all of the requirements were said anyway, then that would obviate the prejudice requirement. It would be almost impossible to meet the prejudice requirement in that circumstance.
Is there a prejudice requirement in a motion to withdraw a plea of guilty?
Yes, there is. It has been applied in consistently in felony cases, for example, and it was said in Stilbis law in State versus Nero.
Has it been demonstrated here?
I can definitively say it has not, because at his motion to withdraw hearing, he never alleged that the colloquy was inadequate. He presented zero testimony about the colloquy. And in fact, if you read the index at the end, you can see the words no contest never appear at any point in the transcript at his motion to withdraw his guilty plea.
So if there's a requirement to demonstrate prejudice before a motion to withdraw a guilty plea can be granted, and there's no showing of prejudice, did the Court of Appeals address that issue?
No, it simply did not identify that prejudice was required at all. It didn't identify, much less apply, the prejudice requirement. Are there no further questions? I would like to reserve any remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Appel. Mr. English.
May it please the court, my name is Brent English, and I represent Joseph Jones. Your Honors, and this is a very straightforward case of the complete failure by the trial court to apply properly Criminal Rule 11E, which on its face says that a court shall not accept a plea of guilty or no contest without first informing the defendant of the effect of the plea of guilty, no contest, and not guilty. This is not in the disjunctive, this is in the conjunctive, and this is a rule that this court has adopted unequivocally that sets forth exactly what it is that a trial court is supposed to do.
Is there a requirement that a defendant should first raise that issue with the trial court before prosecuting it on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, there's no way.
The trial court would have an opportunity to correct whatever error might be there?
Well, in this case, we have a defendant who's obviously not a lawyer, and as the Chief Justice pointed out, he was pretty sideways with his lawyer by the time he got to this point in the case.
So,
how can he raise this question if he does not know that he has a no contest plea available to him, which is the reason for the rule? He cannot be expected to raise with the trial court as some kind of a waiver of his right.
So are we going to create an exception for pro se litigants who don't know that they should first raise the issue with trial courts before presenting it to appellate courts?
I don't think we need an exception at all. I think what I'm saying to you, and I think is clearly the law, is that a trial court must comply with 11E, period. It is not very hard. And in fact, if you read the effects of the pleas in 11B, it takes less than 30 seconds to do.
I understand your position with respect to what a trial court must do in accepting a plea, but this is a case that's presented factually to us, and the issue presented is on the withdrawal of a guilty plea, and it's been my understanding that there is a requirement that prejudice be shown before a court would entertain such a motion. Do you agree with that?
I do not. I think you that don't is a think misconstruction that there's of the law.
You don't think there's a necessity to show prejudice as a result of the plea before the court would entertain a motion to withdraw?
I think by definition, the failure to comply with 11E demonstrates prejudice to a defendant who is uninformed by the court and by the plea form that well, no contest is available.
Assume for the moment that court had indicated the definition of a no contest plea. You'd have no problem then.
That's the court's obligation. Absolutely no problem with
that. What prejudice is it as a result of the court not doing that in this case?
Mr. Jones was uninformed that he had an opportunity to enter a plea of no contest and all the potential advantages to him entering a plea of no contest, including not getting sued over this alleged incident by three minor victims who still have statutes of limitation of it, or that are not barred by any statute of limitation.
The right
to challenge the validity of the conviction based upon his assessment that under the new constitutional amendment that these individual victims were not family or household members, and therefore the domestic violence statute didn't apply to him.
Thank you.
Why isn't the prejudice the fact that, as B says, the plea of guilty is complete admission of defendant's guilt, and as we know, the plea of no contest is not an admission of defendant's guilt, but admits to the facts. That could have consequences for anyone who's pled guilty, who could have pled no contest, could have consequences beyond this case, obviously.
Absolutely.
I mean, it seems to me that just that alone is prejudice.
Exactly my point, which coming back to it, Rule 11E is very straightforward. It is unequivocal. It is not some substantial compliance exception. It just says, look, this is what you need to do, and if you can do it in less than a minute, certainly that's hardly a burden. And Amicus argued in this case that this is somehow going to confuse the defendant. That's preposterous.
Counsel, you're looking at 11E, and it says, without first informing the defendant of the effect of guilty, no contest, not guilty. Are you arguing that the court may not inform the defendant through a plea form?
No, I'm not.
Are you saying in this case that there was no plea form that showed the effect of a no contest plea?
Absolutely, I am. If you look at the plea form that has been suggested by the state as somehow satisfying this requirement, although I believe the rule says it clearly that the court shall inform the defendant, and obviously the much better practice is to inform the defendant on the record of exactly what the issue is to make sure the defendant doesn't have issues or concerns or questions or is confused. But the form in this case is a form that simply indicates, and please look at it, it's got a check mark for no contest, a check mark for guilty, and no description whatsoever of what the effects of these pleas are. That clearly does not satisfy 11.
Although if the form itself did recite the effect of each form of plea, and let's just assume that that's the case, and in a colloquy with the defendant, the court, seeing that a defendant was pleading guilty, went into more language about the guilty plea and may have forgotten to mention the no contest, would it be sufficient for the information under 11E if it was in the plea form?
Your Honor, that's obviously not the issue specifically before you, but I would respectfully submit that it is not sufficient, that the rule says what it says, and it says
it doesn't say orally. It doesn't say.
I agree.
I mean, if we're trying to parse, and you're saying we look at or instead of and, then we look at first informing, and we notice it doesn't say orally.
Well, okay, I accept that. But what I don't think we're parsing words to use what the rule expressly says. Rule 11E is different than 11C, which applies to felonies.
Right, so if we accept your argument, would we, in essence, be requiring more of judges who take misdemeanor pleas than we are currently with judges who take felony pleas?
No, we're not. A judge that takes a felony plea must comply with the terms of 11C, and that is set forth very precisely, and that does not include a description of the effect of a plea of no contest.
Are you arguing that this is a constitutional right that the defendant has?
Your Honor, I think it's a due process right. I know that we just immediately assume that since it's in a rule, it's not a constitutional
right.
Do you agree
it's a substantial compliance standard?
Well, if it's a constitutional right, the answer is no. If it is a non-constitutional right or requirement, the answer would be yes.
So you're arguing it's a constitutional due process right of the defendant, which requires strict compliance.
I agree. And moreover,
is that your point?
That is my first point. But even if you assume it is not a constitutional requirement, clearly it is not substantial compliance to ignore the rule.
What about Stewart, Griggs, and Nero?
Well, Griggs, I think, is the relevant case. And in Griggs, which was a felony case decided under 11C,
yes.
The issue was whether or not there had been a description, a specific description, of the effect of a plea of guilty. The plea of guilty is a complete admission of the defendant's guilt. The defendant said those words weren't spoken, therefore there was reversible error. But on the record in that case, there was a colloquy, there was a discussion from the prosecutor in the presence of the defendant, which was never rebutted by the defendant, of all the facts that suggested that he was guilty. There is a plea agreement that was made in that case where the defendant expressly agreed to plead guilty. And under those circumstances, where you've got a written agreement that you plead guilty and a specific delineation on the record of the facts that support the plea of guilty and no issue whatsoever, no Alford plea, no nothing like that, this court held that was substantial compliance. That is very different than this case, where there wasn't even an effort made, although they point out, the state points out, and Amicus points out, that there were lots of discussions about what Mr. Jones's rights were. He had a right to a jury trial. He had a right to subpoena witnesses. He had no obligation to testify. It couldn't be commented upon, none of which, by the way, were required in a petty offense case under Watkins. But despite that, the one thing that was required was not given.
Counsel, could you point me to the authority that this is a constitutional right?
Your Honor, there is no case that expressly holds one way or the other. There is a case that you have this court has determined where there are certain these are known as non-constitutional requirements. That's what you had indicated. I think in a misdemeanor case such as this, it is a constitutional requirement to tell a defendant what the plea options are.
That's your opinion, but you
that's
have
correct.
No
there is no
case
authority.
Law that would support
that's correct.
You. In fact, there's case law that says that this is a statutory or a rule violation or error, and that the necessity is prejudice to be shown.
The necessity is substantial compliance. The necessity, you must substantially comply. The word substantially shouldn't be written out of that sentence. Comply, substantially comply. Let's say you had read.
And if you do not substantially comply, is that the end of the analysis, or is there a requirement of a showing of prejudice?
There is no method by which a defendant can show prejudice. What I'm hearing the state say is that unless you enter an Alford plea, you can't show prejudice. That clearly cannot be the case. The rule doesn't say it, and it's logically incorrect. The prejudice is that the defendant doesn't know what his or her options are. That is prejudice on its face. And it's not necessary for a defendant to come in and say, oh, by the way, had I pled no contest, then I would have avoided a lot of civil consequences. I would have potentially avoided an enhancement statute down the road. I could have potentially gotten judicial review, which of course he could have, on the legal issue that he raised and preserved in the trial court, which is the validity of the charge on its face, the constitutional validity of the charge, which of course he lost by virtue of pleading guilty.
Counsel, if we rule in your favor and find that strict compliance is required, are defendants then permitted to go back and reopen cases where this was not done?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because, well, first of all, there has to be a case in controversy. I think that a defendant under those circumstances could not come back and say, now there's been a change in the law, so now I'm entitled to reopen my case.
Would it apply to all cases on direct appeal?
I think it would. And I think it's appropriate. You know, we sometimes just lose sight of what the rules say. And in this case, you've made it unequivocally clear what the rule is. And the record in this case is very clear that it was not complied with. I don't think it's a very big leap to say, as a result, my client deserves relief.
And then you would also, by implication, if you had a client with a felony that had pled, advise them that it would apply to a felony?
Well, Your Honor, not necessarily. It would depend on the facts. I appreciate that there is a precedent in this court that this is not a constitutional right. So if the operative standard is substantial compliance, you said strict compliance, but let's assume that it's substantial compliance. I don't think it's very hard to say if you don't substantially comply, that's reversible error, and send it back. That is an appropriate, that's an appropriate relief in this case.
Well, the conjunctive and is in 11E for misdemeanants, but the conjunction or the disjunctive is with respect to the felonies in 11C. Do you agree with that?
I do.
So there is a distinction in the rule? Is that what you're arguing to us with respect to the standard that a court should apply for felons as opposed to misdemeanants?
On its face, the rule says what it says.
I'm not asking what the rule says. I'm asking you what your argument is with respect to the court's obligation for felons versus misdemeanants.
Well, under a Rule 11C plea, Your Honor, if a defendant is going to plead no contest, it is clearly obligatory on the trial court to explain the effect of that plea. What 11C does not say in respect to felons is that you have to explain the effect of all three pleas to a felon who is entering a plea. That is the way the rule is designed. And the reason I submit is that when you enter a plea in a felony case, there is an entire colloquy that is required constitutionally and statutorily and certainly in the rule that one must go through with the defendant. And there is a specific plea that's identified, and at that point, that is the plea that the rule requires be described. In that instance, you only have to describe the effect of that particular plea. In the misdemeanant context, where you've got typically oftentimes many unrepresented defendants and oftentimes persons who don't have any real sophistication or knowledge or just there on a simple case, like this one, for example, the rule has erred on the side of caution to require a trial court to inform the defendant of the effects of all three pleas.
So, counsel, are you saying that there's a policy issue promulgated here that because chances are, or it's more likely, in a misdemeanor situation, there's not legal representation than in a felony situation? That would explain the difference in the requirements?
Your Honor, I'm not presuming to understand why the rule is written the way it is, although I think that is a legitimate
inquiry. Well, let me suggest one. Okay. Most traffic offenses are misdemeanors. A lot of traffic offenses occur in conjunction with an accident for which there is civil repercussions.
Correct.
Far more so than the run-of-the-mill felonies.
That's correct. That could be a very good justification for why the rule is written in the way it is. My point is, the rule says what it says. Comply with it. It's not very hard.
So, counsel, piggybacking on a question that Justice Lanziger put forth, there is no requirement for oral instruction. You would agree with that? So,
Your Honor, I would agree there's no requirement, but I think it's certainly a much better practice.
Well, maybe so, and I don't disagree with that, but a colloquy along with a acceptable form that would distinguish and explain the three different pleas, signed and acknowledged, would be sufficient to comply. Would you agree with that?
It could be. I still don't think that's the appropriate way to do it, but...
Well, we're not talking about best practices. We're talking about what would be sufficient here. And based upon your statements and a reading, I would venture to say that a colloquy plus a complete form containing the substantive information would be compliant.
And an opportunity to have for the defendant to ask questions about the form. If he or she was
sure,
misled.
Which would be part of the colloquy.
Perhaps that would be sufficient.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. English, before you sit down, I have a question.
Sure.
Because in all of this, it's still not exactly clear to me. Under Rule 11B, which of those are you asserting that were not complied with? All of them, or just a no contest plea, or what?
Actually, all three of them. There was not even a description of the effect of the plea of guilty. But that's the plea that my client actually entered. But there was surely not a word said about the effect of a plea of no contest, and there was nothing said that he has a right to remain to maintain his plea of not guilty as well.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, Mr. English. Mr. Cartwright-Jones, you've used your time, which may take 30 seconds. Mr. Appel.
Very briefly, in response to the duty to object at trial, a defendant is able to raise any claims that he was not informed of matters through a Sixth Amendment claim under Rule 32.1. In fact, the claim here was a Sixth Amendment claim, but not about the colloquy. It was on the different issue. Moreover, that Rule 32.1 issue does not have a time limit. So if this court does order strict compliance, we could expect a number of defendants to be filing Rule 32.1 motions asking to withdraw their guilty plea. Finally, I do want to point out that Griggs, although they attempted to distinguish, it should be noted that on paragraph 2, this court said that the syllabus law of Griggs expressly applies to Criminal Rule 11E as well as Traffic Rule D. Finally, in terms of the prejudice matter, this court, I heard some expressions of questions if you don't comply with it. There is an example where a court applied the 10th District standard. They said that in State versus Robbie, out of the 2nd District, one of the cases this court certified as a conflict, the defendant received relief because there was no showing that the court had complied with, had explained the loss of the right of a jury trial, and therefore reversed, even applying the 10th District standards, the ones that we are urging this court to adopt.
Thank you, Mr. Appel.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.